Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sunny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm dandy.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Marvel jobs are fleeing Georgia, and higher-ups at the studios are blaming labor costs. Labor costs is what the issue is. Here's the Wall Street Journal. Marvel is one of many Hollywood companies that have shot in Georgia to take advantage of the state's generous production tax credits. It made nearly two dozen superhero movies and TV shows in the Atlanta area. But beginning with this summer's The Fantastic Four, First Steps, Marvel is making most of its upcoming content in the United Kingdom. Rising costs in Georgia mean it's now cheaper to shoot in the UK, according to a person familiar with the matter. Marvel's departure is part of a nearly 50% drop in production spending in Georgia over the past 3 years. The precipitous decline has raised questions about whether state subsidies built a Hollywood of the South or sparked a gold rush that's ending faster than it began. End quote. The Journal, citing unnamed sources, said that the tax credit in situation is similar, quote, similar, to Georgia's, but the real issue is cost. Pay is supposedly lower in the United Kingdom. Studios don't have to pay for health care. And it's interesting because there are a kind of a fascinating bundle of issues here. But I'm mostly curious about the studio sources framing this as an issue of labor cost rather than subsidies, because there aren't any real numbers in the story about the difference in salary cost or what it costs studios to contribute to IATSE's health plan versus the British equivalent union, which I assume doesn't have to worry about healthcare costs as much since their care is subsidized by National Health Services. The story really does seem pretty straightforward. And it really is the story that the author Ben Fritz kind of lays out here. Georgia offered massive tax rebates of about 30% to studios, which moved tons of production to the state. Basically, if you spent $200 million in the state, they would give you a check for $60 million. It's not quite like that simple, but more or less. Much of the story much of his story is taken up by Californians who moved east chasing jobs. Some of them moved back to Atlanta, where they came from. It's like the opposite of the initial Hollywood boom, right, that you see in movies like Babylon. People, you know, going westward to chase their fortune, instead they were going east. The UK topped that offer, right? The number initially touted by UK film credit supporters was around 40%. It's apparently closer to 32.5% after everything is taken into account. But even if you just take that gap, even if you take that number at face value, the gap is pretty substantial, right? 2.5% on a $200 million movie is $5 million, right? That's nothing to sneeze at. And again, I don't doubt that people in the UK are cheaper to hire. The GDP in the UK, much lower. Standard of living, lower. You know, I get it. But all of this is indicative of a real race to the bottom. More subsidies, cheaper labor, huger budgets for bigger spectacle and dumber stories, because more budget means, hey, more subsidy. This all feels unsustainable. The end result is going to be like $500 million movies getting made every year with a 80% subsidy offered by some Saudi sheik to shoot in a soundstage in the middle of the 130 degree desert, right? And this is not, I'm not like just spitballing here. Those sound stages are being built in Saudi Arabia as we speak. And the leaders are there. They're like, well, we got a lot of oil money here, guys. Who wants to come make some movies in Saudi Arabia?
In Neom, Peter, the city of the future.
Exactly. It's, you know, you come to Riyadh. That's where all the cool kids are hanging out. Peter, is there any way to stop this vicious cycle?
Yeah, you can stop it. I mean, you could just stop subsidizing these things. And what we have right now is at least in the United States, but internationally, you have a race to subsidize these productions. And it's bad for taxpayers and it's bad for movies. And this is the thing that I think has become even more clear over the past 10 or 15 years. And we started seeing these subsidies, decades ago, and they've only grown since. And the story, every time you see some state become the leader in film tax credit subsidies, is pretty much the same. A lot of productions move to that state. We saw this with Michigan. We saw this even more so with Louisiana for like a 10-year, it wasn't quite a decade, but for several years, it just sort of bizarrely felt like, why is everything being shot in Louisiana? And of course, the reason was that there were giant film tax credit subsidies in Louisiana. Just like a funny aside on this is the Gerard Butler, Olympus Has Fallen, The Gerard Butler one, not the
Olympus
Channing
has
Tatum
fallen.
One.
Olympus so Has
there's
Fallen?
There's a very good sequence in the opening act break in that movie, about 25 minutes in, on the White House lawn, in which like the rogue North Koreans invade the White House. It's actually great. I like this sequence.
Great movie.
It's a pretty good movie. And that sequence was shot on a mock-up of the White House lawn that they built in freaking Louisiana. They built the White House lawn in Louisiana because that was the cheapest way to do it because of the film tax credits. And you know who was paying for that? The citizens of Louisiana. Yeah. And guess what is not happening? According to basically every study from liberal think tanks, from outside consulting groups that have no partisan affiliation, and from like free market think tanks, whenever you analyze these things, you always find that taxpayers come out worse. Yes, you get all these politicians saying, and of course the industries themselves saying, look how many jobs we've created. We've created so many jobs. And there are jobs associated with these industries that are being subsidized. It's not like that no one is being employed. But overall, when you back this out, it ends up hurting, it ends up being a cost to the taxpayer. There was an audit just last year for New York State's film tax credit. And it found that at very best, like if you made the most favorable assumptions, the whole thing was a wash for taxpayers. And most likely it was a net cost that taxpayers were coming out worse for this. There's a similar audit for Georgia in particular that found that taxpayers were only getting back something like 19 cents on the dollar that they were spending in film tax credits. So these things are just a waste for taxpayers. But then what happens is everything starts to look the same. And so this is like one of the things that we bet in the Louisiana period. It's just like, why does everything kind of look like it's swampy, even though you're supposed to be in the Midwest? It was because anything that was not obviously supposed to be in a desert was shot in Louisiana. For the last couple of years, it has been Georgia. It's so easy to identify these small towns in Georgia that are being used as the backdrops for basically anywhere that's in the United States, or sometimes even locations that are supposed to be in Canada, even though Canada has its own film tax credit and incentive program. It's like, oh, this is supposed to be in Missouri or New York or Connecticut or Maine. It's very clearly happening in Georgia because like I grew up near Georgia and you can just tell the foliage and just sort of the way the sunlight works and all of this stuff. And so it makes everything look the same. And then, as you said, Sonny, it also provides a tax subsidized incentive to blow up the budget. One of the reasons that the budgets are so big on these movies that they are cost $200 plus million is because in the state of Georgia, they will basically have the taxpayer pay for one third of that. If they did not have taxpayers paying for a third of that, then that would end up they would have to be like almost certainly their budgets would have to be smaller, at least for a lot of these movies that are not going to earn out. And so we have these gigantic budgets for these films that all end up looking kind of samey, and a huge loss to taxpayers. It's a bad idea. You should don't subsidize this stuff. California should not be looking at this and thinking, how can we double our tax credit or whatever it is they're thinking. I don't think they're actually talking about doubling it, but how can we increase our tax credit?
Okay, so this is all very easy to say. It's very easy for us to say this.
Yeah.
Very easy for us to say this. It is harder.
Extremely easy.
It is harder to, particularly if you have an established industry, something like the newly established industry in Georgia or Hollywood, where they've been watching jobs bleed away from the state for years and years now. And that is accelerated. It is virtually impossible to get stuff made in California anymore. Right. Not virtually, but if you are making a big budget film, you are not shooting it in California. They do not shoot things like that anymore there. They shoot them elsewhere where there are these big subsidies. And if you are in California and you look at this big industrial base that you have and you say, we are losing these jobs, we are not going to, our people are not going to have work to do, you can't just unilaterally disarm.
Yeah, and it's a huge problem. But I would also note that I think the Georgia example is a useful warning to these states that you cannot subsidize your way to a sustainable industry, right? Because I think part of the argument has been that we will get all of these people with all of these talents in one place, right? We will sort of recreate Hollywood and then people will be stuck here because the talent is here. And that is just that is proving to be manifestly untrue in Georgia, right? I mean, I am sure people will still shoot at like Pinewood Studios, right? There, you know, there are certainly facilities there that have sort of people employed, talent in place that can make it easy to do these things. But clearly the pull of the competing subsidies is going to end up being stronger than the pull of the talent that's accumulated in any individual place. And so I think any municipality who does this should be aware not only that they're not going to get particularly good return on their money, if any return at all, but they're not going to build a talent base that proves more important than the subsidies that someone else might offer. And so, you know, Sunny, I think what you're describing is exactly right. Like, this is an arms race from which there is no out. And again, the only way to attack a problem like that is sort of a comprehensive disarmament treaty, right? There are occasionally versions of these subsidy deals that I think might not be so terrible. Mostly, you know, if you look at what's happening in DC with the Commander Stadium right now, I don't think it's a great deal for the city, but I do think that, you know, you have an industry, in this case, the Washington Commanders, that's going to sort of stay near its fan base. There are really high costs to moving, at least in the short term. And the city is going to get, you know, a bunch of housing and community development out of it. And that's just not the equivalent of these movie subsidies. Those industries can move and they will move. And so if communities think that they are going to subsidize their way to a new sort of sustainable industry, they should be prepared to subsidize it forever, because the talent accumulation, the centralization is never going to end up outweighing the subsidies that someone else will offer.
And at higher and higher rates. I mean, that's the other thing, right? Is it's not just we're going to have to subsidize this forever. It's like we're going to have to subsidize it for 30% now and then 35% 10 years from now and then 40% 10 years after that. Like, it's a spiral.
The bargain has been altered and it will absolutely be altered further, right? Like, it's, you know, it's Lando. Nobody wants to be in the position of Lando Calrissian. Everyone thinks they're slick. You know, the deal will keep getting worse.
Yeah, I think Alyssa is right. You can, as you said, Sunny, you can understand how politicians see this as an arms race where they have to bid higher in order to keep these jobs. But look at what is happening in Georgia, where it's, as Alyssa said, the talent isn't staying there. Or if the talent is staying there, they're going to be in trouble. And one of the things that you see in this story is that there are people who made good livings, really quite good livings, well into the six figures as sort of below the line talent here, doing coordination type duties. They bought houses and now they are struggling to pay for their homes. They are struggling to make ends meet because they do not have that kind of work anymore. And Georgia is not going to solve that with ever larger tax subsidies. And what they have done is they created a boom that inevitably led to a bust that leaves them with people who can't pay their mortgages, with people who are out of work, with economic problems, in addition to all of the costs that they imposed in order to get there.
Okay, I'm going to say something here and people are going to get mad at me. Possibly on this show.
That's new. Never happened to Sunny Bunch before.
It's never happened before. All right. So look, here we know. All right. In this situation, we know what the carrot is. The carrot to get people to come make movies in your country and produce things in your state is subsidies. You say, hey, here's some money. Come do it here. Eat this carrot in Georgia, or eat this carrot in California, or eat this carrot in Dallas, Texas. Okay. There is a stick. There is a stick. And it was announced to many jeers by Donald Trump and his folks, John Voight, etc., of a movie tariff of sorts. All right, so we agree that there is this unending spiraling arms race. You can never give away enough money unless somebody's going to come up with 100% subsidy someday. Bring your jobs here, and we'll pay for your whole movie to be made. Okay. There is a stick. The stick is tariffs. The stick is, we will tariff your company 100%. This is what the John Voight plan was. We will tariff your company 100% on whatever the subsidy that you get from overseas is. If you shoot a $200 million movie, you shoot a $200 million Jurassic Park movie in London, and you get a check for $60 million from $65 million, whatever, from London and England, we will tax you at $68 million. You will lose money on this deal. So you should come to California and you should film here or Georgia or Texas or wherever in the United States. You should do this. And there are all sorts of questions about workability, etc. I don't like this plan because I don't like tariffs. I think tariffs are bad. I do think tariffs are bad. I think they create they mess up the system in lots of different ways. But this does it. I am talking myself into thinking that this is a situation in which tariffs are kind of what you have to do to break this vicious cycle. Peter, convince me I'm wrong, because I would like to be wrong about this.
I just don't think you're right. I mean, I just think that tariffs are a tax. The tax that was talked of, the tariff rate that was talked about here, is a 100% tax on foreign productions. I mean, that's just totally crazy.
Subsidy, not the 100%. It would be a 100% tariff on the subsidy.
What happens with... if you do that, is that you will, that this just becomes a gigantic cost center for Hollywood. It's literally, it's the reverse of subsidies. And the subsidies create their own problems by creating a, an artificial boom. A tariff is going to create an artificial and unnecessary bust. Here is my plan. No tariffs and no subsidies. It'll work. It'll work. I promise.
No, but it won't work. How are you going to make people stop giving subsidies? You have no power over England. You have no power over the United Kingdom. You have no power over the Saudi sheikhs.
But then what happens internally? Like, does California tariff movies that are made under production subsidies in Georgia? Like, I don't know.
That's interstate commerce. The Constitution handles that just fine.
Also, it's the tariff on movies as a service, even if it theoretically kind of works in your head, Sonny, I think there are both legal and practical problems with this, because tariffs are basically like tariffs to the extent that we have them are almost entirely on physical goods. And this is talking about tariffing a service.
Yes.
It
would be disastrous. It would be disastrous to the American economy.
This is
100%
agree. Particular Pandora's
like
box.
At best, I have a lot of questions about how this would work. Yeah. But at more likely, my questions are all answered by it would not work well. There would be a lot of problems. And then that's just discounting, like, this would just be tied up in the courts for forever. And in the meantime, who knows what would happen to Hollywood? One of two things, most likely, or some combination of Hollywood would kind of melt down and maybe also just entirely move overseas.
Yeah.
It is right. I mean, that's so these are the things that would happen. Right. And this is why I don't actually I'm playing devil's advocate here, because I don't support it, because what ends up happening is the companies move overseas entirely. Right. There's no reason why Universal has to be based in California. There's no reason 20th Century Fox can't be based in Australia. Right. There's no reason, or 20th Century Studios, I guess, since that doesn't exist anymore. There's no reason Disney can't be a English or French company, right?
Ireland's corporate tax rates have been pretty good. It's complicated now, but like...
And on top of all that, though, there are the second order issues of what happens when you start taxing these things. Well, people tax Amazon. They tax, you know, Amazon Web Services. They tax everything. Like, the whole economy essentially crashes. The whole information economy crashes. So it's bad. It's bad. But you saying, Peter, nobody should give any subsidies anywhere is not a solution. That's worse than a solution. That's because there's nothing there. That's just saying a thing. I would love for that to be the case, but there's no way to enforce it. There's no way to convince everybody else to do it. I don't know what the actual answer is. I don't think there is one. I don't think there is a good one. And that is bad. It's really uncomfortable place to be in as a pundit, right? You don't want to be in a situation where you say, well, there's nothing to be done. But it does kind of feel like this is one of these situations where everything is just broken and the whole industry is just going to collapse on itself at some
point. Woohoo!
We'll be free. We'll be free of this.
Something like that, for sure.
I don't know.
The death of the universe.
I don't know.
I do think that, in fact, over time, subsidies from a place like Saudi Arabia in particular It's not like we wouldn't see movies filmed over there. It's not, I'm not saying that that would run its course and then just go away. But I do want to point us to the example of China, which opened itself to a U.S. film production and has now closed off in a lot of ways. And there are a bunch of reasons, economic and cultural, there. And China, like Hollywood, was both forced to decouple, like in ways that they didn't necessarily want to, but also just did decouple for cultural and political and economic reasons. And so I don't think that it is simply inevitable that like Saudi Arabia could essentially, through subsidies, like just own all of Hollywood, unless they literally just decided to say, anything you shoot here at any budget, we will subsidize effectively the entire cost. In which case, but they can't do that. Like they can't be just like.
But Peter, this is a totally incompatible comparison, because what Hollywood wanted was the Chinese audience. Yes. Hollywood wanted the Chinese audience. They didn't produce films in China. Nobody was shooting in China except for the like random extra scenes to get approval to be a co-Chinese production. Nobody wanted to produce movies in China. The Chinese wanted Americans to come there and produce movies because then they could learn how to make better movies. And this is what has happened.
But
Saudi Arabia doesn't care. Saudi Arabia, frankly, probably doesn't want us giving them their movies. They don't want us feeding our Western propaganda to their people. They want Hollywood to come there and for it to be a sort of, you know, I don't know, crown jewel. Like, oh, look, we've got Hollywood now. We've got LIV Golf. We've got, you know, this F1 race. That doesn't work. I agree that nobody should give anybody subsidies for anything. That would be the ideal state of affairs. That is not the world in which we live, and it is not going to be the world in which we live ever, ever. It's never going to happen. And so,
well, there are a lot of things that are unlikely to happen that we would like to happen, and we should say we'd like that to happen. And in any case, the end game here has nothing to do with subsidies, because AI filmmaking is just going to take over, and you won't need to subsidize that in the same way. And there's a totally different mechanism for subsidizing it through, you know, all of these state-owned chipmaker, like we're now just going to quasi-nationalize Intel instead.
Yes, well, that's a
also bad. Said, to be clear, bad. Don't do that.
Also, as I said, the collapse of the industry is coming. That's basically what we all have to look forward to. All right. So, is it a controversy or a non-controversy that film productions have fled Georgia to the United Kingdom, Alyssa?
It's a controversy. It was inevitable.
Peter,
it's a controversy that state governments have been funding giant budget productions for decades now.
Well, I mean, I agree with both of these. It's both a controversy and a controversy, because, like, I don't know what Georgia expected. If you just give people money, somebody else is going to come along and give them more money. But also, it's bad. It's bad for America. It's bad for Georgia. It's bad for the film industry at large. And it would be nice if things that were bad stopped happening. But that is not the world in which we live. So
I agree with that.
All right. No bonus episode this week. Don't wake up early on Thursday to download what we got for you, because we got nothing. So we're just going to get on to Nobody 2, starring Bob Odenkirk as Hutch Mansell, a not quite John Wick level assassin whose efforts to deny his own nature in the first film, Nobody, led to an explosion of violence, war with the Russian mob, and big piles of burning cash. As the sequel begins, Hutch is paying off the debt from that burning stack of Russian cash by doing jobs for his former government handler. Snatch and grabs lead to lots of murders, which lead to late nights, which lead to stress at home. His wife, Becca, who's played by Connie Nielsen, just wants a family meal every once in a while. Is that too much to ask? So Hutch packs up the family, including the kids and dad. Christopher Lloyd plays him. They head on down to Plumbersville in the upper Midwest, a town whose claim to fame is that it has the oldest water park in the country. That's what I like to hear when I'm going down a water slide. This is the oldest water slide in America. And it's also, by the way, a trade route of sorts for bootleggers and drug smugglers and other disease smuggling types. Shocker, Hutch runs into... What's that?
Viruses.
Viruses, what? Yes, evil viruses. Hutch runs into such evil sorts. Chaos and violence ensue. The family must learn to murder together, to stay together. And then a corrupt sheriff, played by Colin Hanks, shows up, and there's a deranged gangster, played by Sharon Stone. They bring War to Plumbersville, et cetera, et cetera. This is a weird movie. It's a weird movie because it feels like a movie that has been chopped down to the absolute barest of bones. And I want to try and sum that up by explaining. There's a dog. There's a dog in this movie. In the opening shot of this film, we see Hutch being interrogated by the feds. The camera pans over and we see he's sitting next to a dog. It's a big dog. It's a wolf dog. Wolf dog, as it turns out. And this is a promise to the audience. You have Hutch next to a dog, and they've both been arrested. The feds have arrested this dog. This is a promise to the audience. It's a tease of wolf dog action to come, right? And we see the wolf dog in a cage at the water park, and Hutch's daughter is like, oh, look at this dog. He looks so sad. And the dog's handler is like, that dog is dangerous. Don't mess with that dog. And we're getting excited for this dog because, like, remember the dogs in John Wick 3? Those dogs were awesome. There's this big dog. It's going to do some awesome things. And then Hutch lets the dog free, and we're like, yes, this dog is going to fuck somebody up, pardon my French. And we are excited. We are excited for this dog. And then the mayhem starts and the dog shows up kind of in the corner and Hutch like whistles to it. And we don't see anything with the dog. There's no dog action. No dog action in this movie. The dog is virtually absent from the entire film, which leads me to believe that there's an entire subplot of this movie involving a dog that got cut at some stage in the filmmaking process. The Chekhov's dog went unfulfilled. It was not paid off. And I don't appreciate that. And that's kind of what this whole movie is like. There's hints of a terrorist plot, and there's some stuff with Hutch's past and family vacations. There's just no payoff to any of it. And the whole thing is kind of designed like so many 87 North Productions, which is the studio that made John Wick and some of the other stuff. I think they made Bullet Train as well. I don't know. They made a lot of these types of movies. All of these films are excuses to stitch together some cool fight scenes in interesting ways. Like, have you imagined what it would be like to get in a fight in an arcade? This movie will show you. This movie will show you. Have you ever wondered what it would look like if you hit a high striker? You know, the thing with the big mallet and you hit it real hard and the thing goes up and it dings the bell because you're so strong, right? What if you tied a bunch of grenades to those and it went off? Sure, fine, let's do that. The action is well shot. The film is amusing enough. I wouldn't say I was bored exactly, but everything just feels weightless. I don't care about any of these people. I don't find the action entertaining enough to make up for it. Neither of these movies do anything for me, right? They're competent action programmers. Bob Odenkirk is kind of fun to watch in this incongruous role as the family man killer type. But the whole thing is kind of a slog. Again, not boring, but I was checking my watch like, okay, how much more time until we're out of here? Despite it being a mere 89 minutes long, Alyssa, I don't know. This movie did not work for me. Did it work for you any better?
No, it did not. And I sort of like the concept of a family movie that's like a little bit just sort of more modest, right? I mean, you know, this is not a movie where this is not the White Lotus, right? Like, they're not going to Sicily and murder is ensuing. Like, they're going to an amusement park and like a sort of cheesy boardwalk-esque kind of Jersey Shorey town. And I do think that there is something charming about that. I, you know, as someone who spent a lot of time at like a very rickety old amusement park in Massachusetts when I was growing up, like that whole concept scratched a certain itch for me. And I do think like just watching them rig up the amusement park to be used as a series of murder traps was probably the moment in the movie that I enjoyed the most. But this is ridiculous. Like, Connie Nielsen is also an assassin. Like, you know, RZA's become like a samurai in Japan. It's like making matcha. What is this? It literally felt like they were playing sort of action movie bingo where they're like, you know, you've drawn the card that's like dog, RZA is samurai, Christopher Lloyd amusement park, right? And it's like, it feels very random. And I also just don't know how I feel about the idea that like family values just involve killing a lot of people and that like, it's good family values to progress from being like a dirtbag assassin to being like, you know, a sort of professional, competent family man assassin to like someone who just a teenage boy who just like chokes the hell out of someone, but doesn't actually murder him. And again, like, there's something interesting about the question of, like, what should you do to defend your family, right? It's like, I will tell you, if some bouncer at an arcade hit the back of my kid's head, there would be a lot of trouble. It would probably not be violent, but it would involve, like, harsh words and serious confrontations and, like, a real attempt to mess that person's life up, right? Like, nobody gets to touch my kid and get away with it. But the movie's sort of gleeful, like, oh, you should just go absolutely to the max every time someone threatens you, is weird. And then everything about Sharon Stone's character is awful, just, like, awful and insane. And I think part of where this movie runs into trouble is that you have this sort of modest setup, right? Like, you've got the duck boats, you've got the, like, you know, the rickety water slides and stuff. And then you have some, like, you know, someone with, like, a million goons and, like, a casino that she can just burn down. I just, like, there's a mismatch between, like, vast criminal empire, itty bitty water park, that makes the movie feel just bizarre and even more sort of bingo or charades like. Also, every moment they spent in those hotel rooms, I was like, I can feel bed bugs on my skin and it makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, I like, again, I the whole, you know, the kind of, like, cheesy, cheap vacation town thing, I can get with it, but I don't know. It didn't work. Peter, what did you make of Nobody 2?
I didn't love it, and I thought it just was a kind of wasted potential in a lot of ways. Number one, with Baba Odenkirk, who is great, but not great in this. I wouldn't say he's terrible, and I understand why he took this job, especially the first one, which I think was not maybe a great movie, but better, although it's a little hard to disentangle from the fact that it was literally the first movie I saw after the lifting of the COVID restrictions. Obviously, Tenet was a sort of weird thing in the middle there, but, like, Alyssa and I got to see a movie together for the first time with, the again, one weird exception in, like, 13 months, and that was kind of great. But the first one actually used Bob Odenkirk better. And Odenkirk is a guy who has become a dramatic actor, but comes from a comic background. And you just don't see his charming comic chops in this movie. I won't quite go so far as to say he is phoning it in, but it's remarkably lacking in, like, even one single good Bob Odenkirk riffing moment. And it's like, they either didn't want him to do that, or he just didn't feel like doing that on set, or all of that stuff got cut in what is very clearly, this movie's at least 15 minutes and maybe 40 minutes longer at some point here. And so I thought that was a real missed opportunity. But I also thought a lot of these action scenes, even the ones that were kind of okay and kind of clever in points, were also missed opportunities. And you could see what they were doing, kind of the way they were riffing on the first one. The first one had this real Looney Tunes logic. The action beats were not these extensive sort of long play sequences where you got to sort of play out an action idea. What you basically got in the first one were, with a maybe exception of that, of the bus fight, what you got in the first one were just these, like, quick setup punchline gags, and they worked reasonably well for what they were. Again, it's not a great movie, but it was one that I kind of enjoyed. And here you have the same approach to action, and it just doesn't work. The gags just don't come across because there's not nearly enough time spent setting them up. And so then when they pay off, it's just like, oh, okay. They also don't look all that great. But you can imagine, I know that some of the John Wick guys worked on this film, production and writing capacity, right? I know that some of them were, you know, they were involved here. But you can imagine much more John Wick-esque kind of approaches to some of these sequences. There's a little bit in the end in which some of the bad guys get taken out by one of those big swinging boat things, right? Like, it's hard to even, yeah. What do you even call that? But it's like, you know, you see,
like,
these
Viking ship.
The Viking ship that swings back and forth at a fair, right? And there's some explosions involved. And you can just imagine that the guys who made John Wick 4 with that, like, interminably hilariously long sequence at the Arc de Triomphe and the freaking Frogger in that circle, right? And that sequence I don't know how long it actually is, but in my head, it's like 12 full minutes of John Wick playing Frogger in that circle. And it's just like, let's take this in that John Wick moment. It's let's take this idea and iterate and build and complicate and iterate and build. And it just becomes like kind of you at some point you sort of start to like cackle at how absurd and how cacophonously crazy it all is. And this movie never takes any of its ideas, never lets them play out. It doesn't take them and build or do anything with them, except it's like, oh, we're at a theme park. We'll just use all this stuff. Okay. But like, I want to see some development in these action ideas. If you're going to do this kind of action movie, you need to take those gags and you need to use them. First, give me the obvious way, then give me the less obvious way, then add a complicating element, then complicate it one more time, flip it back on its head and bring it back. And oh, give me the punchline. I want to see the 4-minute version of the Viking swing trap. Right. And we never get anything like that.
Right. It definitely feels like a movie where the people who wrote the action scenes hadn't been to it like a carnival in 15 years. And as someone who goes to like a Lions club carnival every summer, let me tell you, there are so many people. There are so many ways to murder people at a carnival. There are so many of them, right? Like, this doesn't do anything with merry-go-rounds. It doesn't do anything with any of the crazy stuff with centrifugal force. Like, it doesn't do anything with, like, you know, the really crazy stuff that goes upside down, right? Like, can't you do something where you like rig, you trap some henchmen in one of these things that goes upside down and you rig all of the like security harnesses to let go and you just like squash a bunch of guys on their heads? Like, there is so much murder potential in carnivals and water parks.
Or, I mean, I hadn't even thought of the centrifugal force, right? Those just like absolute puke machines.
Yes.
Right? So imagine a version of this where they're all stuck inside the thing and they keep getting sucked back to the wall. And also some of them start to vomit because they can't, because it's literally just so
like
crazy.
Fly some of them out of there. Like, I want to write
Nobody 3 this afternoon based on all of this, but like, I don't want it to be this movie. I want it to be a better version.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. I do wonder if we have, I think there is some probably John Wick knockoff fatigue at this point. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how many. And like, it's what I didn't love Bullet Train either, but at least Bullet Train had like interesting characters who are like kind of cartoony and goofy. And in this movie, you have a very straightforward, like corrupt Southern cop. I guess not Southern. I guess he's from, you know, what are they're in Wisconsin or something. They're in like the upper peninsula in Michigan or someplace.
Yeah. Although it was shot in Canada, I think because of film subsidies, that would be
probably
my guess. I haven't seen reporting to that effect, but like, it's pretty sure it was shot in Canada. And if I had to guess, probably because of the subsidies.
You got a knockoff, knockoff cop. You got the like corrupt carny owner who has a heart of gold. You've got Sharon Stone who like is totally wasted in this movie. She's crazy. Oh,
yeah,
she's so violent.
Psychopath. Yeah.
She's a violent psychopath, but she's not an interesting psychopath. There's a difference, but you can do a violent psychopath who's interesting. It's an Anton Sugar type. But her, there's the most interesting thing she does is kind of like dance with her headphones on. Remember when she dances? That's interesting. Isn't it? I don't know. I feel like there's a Sharon Stone has a good crazy killer character in her.
Yeah.
It's just not this movie. It's just not this movie.
Nope.
The villain escalation here felt a lot actually like the old Mel Gibson movie Payback to me, which of course was famously completely rebuilt in edit. They basically shot a whole new third act more or less with a different villain, but that movie moves through a series of villains until you get to someone at the very, very, very top, kind of in this way, except that movie has a lot of character and it is very stylish in terms of the way that it's shot. I mean, there's all this blue gray filter stuff before the, which I think was mostly done using film development rather than digital color correction. But just to, what was the movie you just mentioned, Sonny? Bullet Train, which I also didn't love, but like a thing about that film that made it much more interesting was first of all, Brad Pitt gives a pretty good Brad Pitt performance. It's not his greatest, but he shows up in his funny bucket hat and he's constantly talking to his handler. And it's like, it's just a bunch of good Brad Pitt bits. But second of all, that movie, again, I didn't love it, but that movie is interestingly stylish all throughout. It demands that you kind of look at the visual details in ways that are like, it just insists upon, like, look at this technicolor bizarro world that we have created, and then allows you to, like, actually sort of gives you a tour of this crazy train, where this movie just doesn't look that great. It's just pedestrian. There is so much CG fire in this movie. So much. And every time there was a CG fire on screen, I just, like, it's like I had a little voice in my head that was like, I'm Sonny Bunch and I hate that.
I do hate it. I hate it. Yeah. I hate it as much as I hate film subsidies. That's how much I hate
it. Yeah.
All right. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Nobody 2? Alyssa.
Thumbs down.
Peter.
I've seen worse action movies this year. The Working Man, or A Working Man, was worse. But thumbs down.
Boy, I don't know. Was this worse than A Working Man? I don't think it was. I think Working Man was slightly better than this.
No.
I think Working Man was better. First of all, A Working Man had an enormous moon. This has zero enormous moons. This movie has zero enormous moons. So think about it that way. All right.
That moon was so big.
I also give this movie a thumbs down. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Dante DiCicco. Tell your friends, strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.